Going to be joined by retired United States Senator Judd Gregg from New Hampshire, three-term governor there. He thinks that the Republicans, and remember, Judd Gregg is known as someone who's kind of a reconciler, you know, someone who believes in trying to get along and get things done. And, you know, has a moderate reputation. In fact, Obama wanted him in his administration, and Judd Gregg took one look and said, no, thank you. But he thinks it's wonderful what the Republicans are doing on sequester. And he thinks that they should hang tough. And I say good for them and good for him. This is important stuff. Here, by the way, is Steny Hoyer on CNBC a few weeks ago, giving you an idea of the climate on Capitol Hill among the Democrats. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Do we have Judd Gregg with us now? Okay, very good. Let's go to him. I didn't think he was going to be with us for a couple of minutes. I got him early. That's great. Senator Gregg, how
John,
are you?
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Very well, John. Doing great. And you?
I'm doing very well.
Are things out in the Great Northwest?
Things out here in the Great Northwest are superb. Just a balmy 53 degrees, nice, gray, overcast skies, rain continuing to fall. What could be more beautiful?
Absolutely. You don't have to worry about getting skin cancer there.
No, not at all. Hey, listen, I've been trying to get you for more than a week to come on the show. I loved your piece in The Hill last month. And I said, you know, we've got to get Senator Gregg on to talk about sequester because, you know, you are known as someone who tries to see the other point of view, who tries to get things done working in a bipartisan manner with the Democrats. And you said it would have been a debacle if the Republicans would have refused to allow the debt ceiling to be extended. But then you say, on the other hand, it's absolutely great that the House Republicans are not giving ground on sequester. And you're glad.
Absolutely.
You're glad the Republicans are hanging tough here.
No question about it. You see, I had the good fortune when I was in the Senate to serve on the Senate leadership for 16 years. And we used to have this code we lived by, which was never take a hostage you can't shoot. And as a very practical matter, the debt ceiling and the continuing resolutions, from a political standpoint, are hostages you can't shoot because all the damage from executing on trying to stop the debt ceiling or trying to not go forward with a continuing resolution, all the political damage falls on the Republican Party. And why is that? Because people don't want the government to shut down, and they want us to pay our interest on our debt, and they know that if we default on our debt, it's extremely damaging to the country. And they certainly want their Social Security checks to be sent out. And so if the debate is about shutting down the government, not paying back the debt, or not sending out Social Security checks, Republicans lose. However, on the other hand, sequester is just the opposite. Sequester is about not spending money we don't have, which is exactly what we should be talking about. It's a $1.2 trillion cut in discretionary spending over 10 years, $85 billion this year. It's being done in a across-the-board way, and that's really not an effective way to cut spending, but it is being done in a manner that is going to force the Congress and hopefully the President to step up and find better ways to cut spending, and it sets a goal, $1.2 trillion. So I think the sequester debate is the absolute right place for Republicans to make the stand. What they should propose and what hopefully the president will participate in, and I guess last night there was a really good meeting with some of the senators and the president, is to replace the sequester, which is an across-the-board discretionary cut, with reductions in the entitlements programs, which will make them stronger and more solvent over a long period of time and also more affordable.
You know,
that's where our problem is.
I think that this idea for the dinner, going out with Republicans after he showed next to no interest in meeting with Republicans as the deadline for sequester was actually approaching. I think, you know, he had these 11 Republican members of Congress out to dinner last night. He's having Paul Ryan over for lunch today. I think they're kind of doing a little bit of damage control here. I think that sequester, they thought, was going to come back and bite the Republicans. And instead, a lot of people are thinking that the Obama White House overplayed their hand, that they exaggerated the sequester. Go ahead, sir.
You're absolutely right, John. You're absolutely right. I think they totally miscalculated what was going to happen. They felt that when, especially when defense took a sequester cut, which it well, and that when some of these social programs took the sequester cuts, that the outrage would be so great that the Republicans would fold their tents and give them some sort of kick the can proposal. Well, to the credit of Speaker Boehner and Majority and Senate Leader McConnell, they've done just the opposite. They said, we're going forward until you come to the table and start negotiating seriously about how we replace these reductions, which should be replaced, with reductions made that are more targeted on the discretionary side and with entitlement savings. And I have to give the president credit here also. He's changed course. There's no question about it. Last night was a major course change, potentially. We haven't seen the actual execution of it, but the potential for a major course change is there. And he is finally engaging in the process personally. You cannot do a big deal, and we need a big deal here, on these major entitlement programs and tax reform unless you have the president in the room participating, and he hasn't been up till now. And secondly, you can't do it unless you do it in a bipartisan way. And why is that? Because these programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and tax reform, the American people don't accept big changes in these programs unless they believe those changes are fair. And fairness in our system requires bipartisanship. So you've got to have both sides at the table, and you have to have presidential leadership to do this. And I'm hopeful, you know, maybe I'm being too Pollyannish about this, but I'm hopeful that last night was the opening of a new process to trying to get it done, because we really do need to straighten our fiscal house. If we don't get this debt under control, John, and you know this, and you've talked about it on your show a lot, actually, my son-in-law and my daughter just moved to Seattle.
Oh, wonderful.
They are big fans of yours, John and Molly Otter, and they're huge fans of yours. They listen to you all the time.
Yes.
So they tell me what you've been saying, and I understand that you've been talking about this a lot, but we've got to get this debt under control, or we're going to pass on to our kids a much weaker country where their standard of living is less and which isn't as safe. And so we've got to do this, and we've got to do it sooner rather than later, because if the longer we wait, the more difficult it will be to do.
Well, the other thing here is the reason why it has to be bipartisan is simply because if the Democrats control one chamber in the legislative branch and they control the executive branch, then the only way it's going to get done is if both parties get some of what they want and give a little ground. I mean, that's the only way it gets done.
That's right. And even if they controlled everything, as they did under Obamacare, when they had total control and 60 votes in the Senate, if you just do a partisan bill, as Obamacare was, the American public doesn't have any confidence in it.
I don't
think it's fair.
Let me do a quick segue. I don't want to get too far afield what we're talking about, but do you think Obamacare will survive, or do you think its costs and its inner contradictions will cause it to implode?
The simple answer is it will not survive. It will be changed fundamentally. Healthcare is the driver of almost all the fiscal problems we have, for lots of different reasons. The biggest one being that we're doubling the number of retirees, and they're all going to demand much more healthcare. We're going from 35 to 70 million retirees as the baby boom generation fully retires. And the Obamacare bill was drafted in a vacuum, and for a lot of reasons,
right.
But one of them was that there wasn't any Republican participation, which would have been constructive for the system, in my opinion. And so as it passed, it will not be executed. It's not going to turn out the way it passed. It's not in 2014-15 when it goes into operation. It's really not going to be much, a whole lot like it was when it passed. And 3 years later, it won't be like it was executed on, because the healthcare system is changing dramatically, and providers are changing how they provide healthcare dramatically. And we're starting to shift fundamentally from a system that rewards utilization and repetition to a system that rewards outcome.
Okay.
You've got a lot of things occurring in communities like in Seattle, where the health community is responding to trying to get costs under control while still maintaining quality, through personal care, through accountable care organizations. There's a lot happening. It's going to change constantly. And there are two fundamental flaws in the Obamacare bill that cannot survive because the politics of it don't work. One is the individual mandate, and when that goes into effect, there'll be outrage, I believe, people being told that they have to buy something they don't want. And second is the exchanges, which are grossly, grossly underestimated in their costs because of the huge subsidy that would be put in place when you start putting people, taking people out of private sector employment insurance and moving them into public sector.
See, I think there's
quasi-public sector.
Can I add a third element real quickly? And that is that Obamacare literally gives employers the incentive to drop employees from the company plan and have them either go on Medicaid, or which is expanding, of course, or partake of these exchanges. And when people learn that they're off their company plan and no longer are guaranteed to see their doctor, there's a third revolt.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
So,
and in fact, the cost doesn't work. Just to highlight the point you're making, the average employer is paying between $8,000 and $12,000 for his employee's insurance, maybe more depending on who the employer is. But if they drop that employee as an insured person and send them to the exchanges, they pay a $2,000 penalty. Well, what employer isn't going to do that? Most employers are going to do that, especially middle-sized employers. And so the exchanges end up totally with a person who they're only getting $2,000 to cover, and where's the rest of the money going to come from, that $8,000 to $12,000?
Exactly.
From the taxpayer.
My guest is Judd Gregg, former United States Senator from the state of New Hampshire, former governor of New Hampshire as well, who has written a series of great pieces in The Hill, one of which said that the Republicans were smart to, you know, basically draw a line in the sand at the sequester issue and not give ground to force the issue of spending control. If you had been at that dinner last night, Judd, what would you have told the president?
I would have said the opportunity is there. This is such a simple situation for us to resolve. Let's get past the politics and solve it. Let's think about what the situation is. We need to reduce our spending to reduce our debt. We need to reduce the deficit by about $5 trillion over the next 10 years. We're going to spend around $45 trillion over the next 10 years. So it's actually probably less than 10%, probably in the 8% range that we need to adjust our spending and our deficit by. That's a very doable number. So let's do it. Let's stop talking about it and let's do it. And let's do it in a balanced way, where we address entitlements, we address discretionary spending, and we address revenues through tax reform and growth.
Can you stick with us for a couple minutes? I know you got a busy day.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Real quickly, Judd Gregg is my guest, retired senator from the great state of New Hampshire, the former governor of the Granite State, whose daughter moved out here about a year ago, Molly and John Otter, live in Mercer Island. And so you're getting out here, too, every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, Kathy and I come out occasionally. We love to visit Seattle. It's beautiful. We've been there. The sun's been shining. I guess Molly gets the sun in for the day. Hmm. And it's such a spectacular area.
Come out more often, then, if you're bringing sunshine with you. I wanted to ask you a couple of more questions moving forward here. You actually were offered, if memory serves correct, you were offered by the Obama people the chance to be the budget director. And you thought about
Commerce Secretary.
What was it? Commerce. Oh, okay. You thought about it and then said, yeah, no thanks. And pulled
right. It was right after he was elected, and I'd known him in the Senate. And I was, as everybody in this country, looking forward to his presidency in the sense that he is a transitional figure for our culture. I think it's very important and an exceptionally positive statement that he was elected president from a cultural standpoint, first African-American president. And so he asked me if I would be willing to serve in his cabinet. And I thought about it for a couple weeks, and it was right in the middle of the stimulus package. And I am rather fiscally conservative, probably one of the most fiscally conservative members of the Senate at the time. And I realized that because I had such differences or was going to have such differences over fiscal policy, that it would be very hard for me to be in the cabinet a cabinet member's number one job is to be 100% with the president 100%
of
the time.
Loyal.
That would have been, yeah, you got to be. And so I made a mistake. I should have realized that before we went public. It was embarrassing to him that I said no after I'd said yes. But it would have been really more embarrassing and more difficult had I taken the job. And he was always very gracious and courteous about it. I very much appreciated the way he handled it. It was my mistake. I should have seen it right up front that it was just too much of a depth of difference on fiscal policy for me to be very
okay.
Be a good secretary.
So let's again, moving forward, you say you're glad the Republicans are holding firm on the sequester. You believed that the Americans would rally around, you know, the core understanding that we've got to control spending. We haven't been controlling spending. Something must be done. And so if you were advising the Republicans where to go from here, what's the next step?
My advice to the Senate leadership, who are kind enough to call me fairly regularly, is put on the table two or three different packages that get to where we need to go, and use those as vehicles to get the discussions going. I think we've got to get past the generalities and into specifics. Now, everybody knows that when you start talking specifics on things like how you're going to adjust Medicare, how you're going to adjust Social Security, or how you're going to change the tax laws, that you immediately generate the opposition from people who are very focused on protecting their small area of interest. But on the other hand, you can't do this in generalities. You've got to get down to specifics. So I think we've got to start talking broad packages. Now, I was on the Simpson-Bowles Commission. We did the package.
Mm-hmm.
We accomplished it in a bipartisan way. The three most fiscally conservative members of the Senate are on that commission, myself, Tom Colbert, and Mike Crapo from your next-door state.
Idaho.
And two very, very liberal members of the Senate voted for it, Dick Durbin and Ken Conrad. And so it can be done. And what you need is something specific to work off of. Now, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson and myself, Ed Rendell, the former governor of Pennsylvania, have formed this group called Fix the Debt. And we've proposed a number of comprehensive proposals here to do this. Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles came out with one 2 weeks ago. So that the specific policy is sitting there and ready to be acted on. It's just a question of getting the leadership to do it, and hopefully last night was the first step in that direction.
If you were asked what it would take for Republicans to retake the White House, what did they do wrong in 2012? What do they need to do right going forward?
We allowed people who were very much at the margin of our party to become the spokespeople of our party. And as a result, instead of being a party that had a broad tent, we ended up with people narrowing our tent. And we did it in a very, very harsh way. We didn't, but the people who were speaking for us did it in a harsh way. What happened was the folks who really had no legitimacy as candidates for president ended up getting very significant visibility in the primary process. And that narrowed our base. And then you had Mitt Romney, who did a great job in the first debate, sort of recovered his footing, and he got the issue back on spending, deficit, jobs, and the economy. And then you had these two candidates, one from Indiana and one from Missouri, Senate candidates, who said ridiculously...
Oh, the whole thing about... about rape and
abortion.
Pregnancy and abortion. Yeah. And
And the Democratic leadership took those and made those folks the image of the party. And so with women especially, educated women who are independents, we lost that vote overwhelmingly because all they heard about were these two people, and they saw our party as harsh. We've got to get back to a party that understands that we need to be able to include people with different views, especially on social issues, and not exclude people, but gather around the issue of fiscal responsibility, opportunity, and individual rights.
Okay.
And allow that to be our theme and be an inclusive party rather than an excluding party, and not be harsh in our rhetoric.
My guest is Judd Gregg. Judd, we only have about 30 seconds or so. Fundamentally speaking, when it comes to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, do we need to restructure the programs, or do we just need to, you know, raise the eligibility for it, trim benefits for the well-off, means test benefits, et cetera?
We need to do a little of both. And the restructuring should go to making Medicare much more a system where we reward outcomes rather than utilization, and where individuals have choices and can choose their coverage they want in a way that brings them into making decisions that are market-oriented.
Right. Okay.
And we also need to adjust provider payments and change.
Do you like Paul Ryan?
Calculate.
Do you like Paul Ryan's plan? Do you like Paul
he's
Ryan's plan?
He's a great and positive force in our party. I think he's one of the really good thinkers.
I completely agree with you. Hey, can we bring you on again sometime soon?
You're happy to, John.
We'd love to, and it'd be great to see you next time you're in town.
Sounds good.
All right.
Sounds good. Thanks. Thank you for your time.
But Judd Gregg, a former senator from New Hampshire and governor of the Granite State, my guest here on Talk Radio 570 KVI.